over $1,300,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000,000 summon your attention, please.
Just a catching strays over here.
You're in for a hell of a show.
Keep the faith. Hold the line and own the libs.
It's time for our main event.
Welcome back to the Ruthless Variety program. I am Michael Duncan, joined with me here, comfortably smug, and John Ashbrook. No Holmes today.
No, unfortunately, he can't be with us today, but you get the three of us, and while we're missing our friend, we're very happy to be with you.
Absolutely. It's a shame. It's a shame we don't have our friend, because this is going to be a fantastic show. I mean, the content for this episode is going to be just incredible. We have, obviously, a ton of news in the presidential horse race, a lot of polls, Wall Street Journal, CNN, the Des Moines Register poll as well, over the weekend or on Monday. A really interesting story. Well, we have two stories of live streams. both involve urinating. We have an update on academia and all the great success at being anti-Semites that they're having. Fat Pride. And we have a great guest, Kellyanne Conway.
We do have Kellyanne Conway, and she makes a little bit of news on the Donald Trump Veep stakes. She talks about what a Trump second term might look like. She talks about this Des Moines Register poll, and we all know she's a great pollster. She breaks it down a little bit, so stick around. You're going to love that interview.
Millions of Americans earn and use credit card rewards. A few big box retailers want to take those rewards away, rewards we use on groceries and school supplies, the cash back to save on gas and grow our small businesses, and travel miles we use to make memories. The so-called Credit Card Competition Act would eliminate credit card rewards. No more travel miles, no more cash back. When lawmakers help mega retailers line their pockets, we pay for it. Tell your lawmaker to vote no on the big box bill. Visit handsoffmyrewards.com to take action today.
It's fantastic. Before we get into the hard-hitting news of the day, we got to talk about the biggest news in football. Your Cincinnati Bengals defeated my Indianapolis Colts. And I think the honorable thing to do would be to acknowledge that, even though I don't want to.
Well, that is the honorable thing to do. And I appreciate you mentioning it. You know, you were very kind to invite me over to your house because I think both of us expected the Bengals, who are now Joe Burrowless, to come up short yesterday.
No, I didn't.
I certainly did, because the Colts were on a four-game winning streak.
The Colts were getting 3 points, I'd remind you, in this game.
They were. Vegas was wrong.
The
Colts look really, really good, and the Bengals just lucked it out. So hopefully they can continue that streak.
So Burrow is pretty messed up, right? Like, I heard it could be really bad.
Well, it is really bad. I mean, he's done for the season. He had surgery on his wrist. There was a torn tendon there, but he's been replaced by this guy, Jake Browning, who was an All-American in high school and very, very good at Washington, and has sort of flown under the radar until his opportunity.
And it almost seems like this is a league-wide issue for some reason. Like, every quarterback, like half the teams, I think, have lost their starting quarterback.
It's the
Colts half is both like backup QB bowl.
It's the strangest phenomenon in the league this year. I feel like half the teams are without their starting quarterbacks. It's been a strange year in the NFL.
Yeah.
You know, up is down, black is white. Quarterbacks are going down, blowing Achilles tendons.
And it's like unprecedented of how like the rules over the past, I'd say, 5 years have made quarterbacks like bubble wrapped. You're not allowed to touch them, and still somehow these people find a way to.
So I have a theory on this, Smug, and that is, like, although they have bubble wrapped the quarterbacks with the rules and everything, and also the officiating this year has been very weird. There's been a lot of controversies on all of that, but you know, while they've bubble wrapped the QBs, everybody's playing in these very low profile shoulder pads now. Like 20, 30 years ago, the only person on the field who wore those sort of pads was the kicker.
It was the kicker.
Right? And now everybody's in these low profile pads. So it's great because it allows for more neck mobility if you're trying to turn your head to catch a football, or you're a wide receiver, or you're trying to look around the field as a quarterback. But it also allows more neck mobility when you're falling to the ground and your head can slam back onto the turf.
Which is what happened to CJ Stroud on Sunday. I mean, it just he's added the list. You mentioned all these backup quarterbacks having to step up. I really think that what Holmes said was pretty funny on our text chain. I don't know if he tweeted this, but he was like, last team with a starting quarterback wins the Super Bowl.
Yeah. No, seriously, we're getting there.
And there have actually been some good stories, like the Giants, their new quarterback's like was Johnny Fettuccine or something. And he does. Yeah.
But, Tommy DeVito.
DeVito, yeah.
Johnny Fettuccine.
And he shows up to do like autograph signings at like delis.
Yeah.
Have you seen this?
Does he really?
Yeah. This is
get
like
an autograph and some gabagool.
Yeah. It's the most like New Jersey, New York story of all time. It was terrific.
Will you sign my ravioli, please?
But that's, and like, I saw this signing he was doing, and then behind them, it was like Johnny Fettuccine's favorite, you know, cold cuts. It's like, what the hell?
For the record, his name is Tommy DeVito again, in case people forgot that. You his also, you mentioned Vegas, Ashbrook. And I got to point out, we had a friendly, gentlemanly wager for $20. And I gave you a lot of guff on Sunday that I was going to pay you in pennies. I wasn't able to get pennies. I was, however, able to get quarters.
Are you serious?
You're kidding me. You're paying me in quarters.
So I'm going to pay you in quarters. But like I said, you were favored by 3 points. So I got to take a little bit of vig out of this.
This
I think
incredible.
It's probably about $1.50.
Don't
so
spend like it 18, all in one place.
Maybe $18.50 for you.
There you go.
There you go.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. That was the honorable thing to do.
Yeah, very honorable.
To go to the bank and get rolls of quarters to pay off your bet. Very, very honorable. Now when I go to Aldi, I'll have what I need to get the grocery.
Yeah,
or you put them in a sock like Johnny Fettuccine. That's how you collect.
Yeah. Next time it won't be in quarters because you'll have your sock with you. Yeah.
Thank you, old man.
So a little additional side business to cover here before we get into the news. The Christmas sale continues. 15% off in the Ruthless Podcast store. You just need to go to the subdomain, which I have created, store.ruthlesspodcast.com.
Mm-hmm.
Get those orders in. Maybe get something for yourself. You know, 'tis the season.
And I would move on that. Make sure that the shipping arrives on time. I've already noticed shipping is in chaos.
Yeah, I mean, look, we aren't Amazon here.
Yeah.
You know, we're the little program that could.
But I mean, in general, like the USPS, FedEx, UPS, I don't trust any of them right now.
Yeah.
They're all bastards. So I would, you know, give them as much time as possible. These are very incompetent people.
One additional thing. Before the end of the year, we're going to be airing a Q&A show. We've been getting a lot of really great comments, most directed towards me in some way with some hate, which I appreciate. Thank you very much. But, you know, we'd really like to get as many questions as possible. We might even do two shows on it, you know, because we've been doing this show for a long time. And I think we owe it to the fans. So if you haven't submitted a question yet, like get it in really, really soon. Mm-hmm. Just send an email to hello@ruthlesspodcast.com. All right. On to the big news. The horse race. We got a huge poll on Monday. The NBC News Des Moines Register MediaCom poll. For people who follow Iowa closely, this is always sort of seen as the gold standard poll in Iowa. The Des Moines Register poll. So it's a pretty big deal. What it shows is Donald Trump at 51%.
Mm-hmm.
DeSantis at 19, Haley at 16, Ramaswamy at 5, Christie at 4. 70% of Trump's backers say their minds are made up.
Mm.
Remember, there was that October poll, which showed, you know, Nikki had made a lot of progress here.
Mm-hmm.
DeSantis in this new one has gained a few points. I think he gained 3. Haley has sort of flatlined there at 16. Mm-hmm. And Trump has gone up, I think, you know, 7 or 8 points from his previous spot in the October poll. So it's positive movement for Trump. He's obviously consolidating a little bit. What are your thoughts?
You know, what I noticed was the positive movement for Ron DeSantis. And we asked a question on our Thursday episode, did the debate actually help any of them? And this poll was in the field during the time of the debate.
Mm.
And I think that the little bit of a bump that he got probably has to do with his performance that night. Obviously, it's nearly immaterial next to Trump's commanding lead. Can any of them overtake Trump in a month? I don't know what they do to change anything up, because that caucus is like sprinting in our direction.
That's the thing, it's what, is it 4 weeks out now? Like, it's right there.
Yeah.
So yeah,
it's mid-January.
If I had to guess, a lot of the thinking right now going around these campaigns is, especially I bet like the DeSantis Haley campaigns are thinking, okay, we got to have as strong as possible showing here, and they're betting on other campaigns dropping after Iowa and then hoping to get that support, consolidate, because 51 is a daunting number, but I guarantee the mindset of these candidates remaining is that, like, okay, I've already seen a few candidates drop out. I think Haley has especially done really well with picking up supporters of the candidates who have dropped out, like Tim Scott, Vice President Pence. Like, a lot of their support seems to have gone in Haley's direction.
You would think so, Smug, and I think there's more evidence of that in New Hampshire. But can you put up graphic one, Nick? You know, if you look at the difference from December to October, you see Trump gains 8, DeSantis gains 3, Nikki exactly where she was. You know, and Tim Scott dropped out, right? Burgum dropped out.
So you think that the DeSantis bump comes from those candidates who dropped out?
Well, DeSantis and Trump.
Yeah.
I think they're either choosing DeSantis or Trump. Maybe Vivek, you know, he gained 1.
Yeah.
Christie's still at 4. Now, these are, you know, small numbers, and the sample size is, what, 500, 500 mm-hmm. and some people. So there could be a little noise in there. But, I think it's hard to argue that candidates dropping out has benefited Nikki Haley at this point. I just don't really see it. Let's put another graphic up there. Graphic 4, Nick. So this is from that same Des Moines Register poll. 3/4 of likely Republican caucus goers say at least they're actively considering Donald Trump. Mm. Ron DeSantis is right there too. You know, 76 considering Donald Trump, Ron DeSantis 67. Right. So, like, on the ballot, Trump's at 51. DeSantis is all the way back there at 19. But he's got an additional 30 who report him as their second choice, mm-hmm. and another 18 on top of that who are actively considering him. Nikki's number is a lot lower. It's in at 52. Now, the reason I wanted to show graphic 4 after graphic 1, because, I mean, my question to you guys is, can Nikki, who the DeSantis people hate when I say this, but I don't care, she surged after those first couple debates. Mm-hmm. I mean, she was down at like 3-4%, right? And now she's at 16 mm-hmm. in Iowa. Clearly, she did have a boomlet there in her support. Can she replicate that down the road after Iowa? Or is she a factional candidate who has a ceiling in this race?
Well, I think, can we put that graphic back up? Because I just want to make sure I get these numbers right. I think that what Nikki Haley has gained in the AFP endorsement mm-hmm. and the huge grassroots network that comes with that, what she has gained is an ability to maximize her support in Iowa. In other words, people who, of course, she's going to get her first choice, but I think that she is more likely to pick up more second choice voters than somebody who doesn't have the kind of grassroots muscle that she now has. You have people going door to door to familiar faces. It's not like an out-of-state person flying in and hoping that they say the right thing. And it's actually a network in town. So anybody who has a strong ground game is going to be able to clean up that vote who's still a little bit undecided, waffling about who they're going to pick. So I think that Nikki's number in Iowa will be one of the most important things to watch, because if she's not able to drive up her support in that state in that first caucus, there are going to be a lot of questions about why.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, I mean, I would think that that campaign is probably going to point towards, okay, after Iowa, you've got New Hampshire, you've got South Carolina.
Easier road.
I would guess that is the argument that they're making.
Mm-hmm.
The tough thing is, I mean, and Ron DeSantis has this too, is in South Carolina and Florida, Trump is still the top polling candidate.
Yeah.
I mean, I think right now these campaigns need to be focused on what can we do. It's almost like the crabs in a barrel problem, you know, like what can we do to get other people out of this race. That should be the number one thing. Like, I know a lot of these campaigns complain. They're like, oh, why are you putting up negative ads about us? Why aren't you attacking Donald Trump since he's in first? But it's like, essentially, Trump right now has 50%. If you want to fight for the other 50, you got to get rid of the competition there.
Okay, so I agree with you, Smug, in one sense. But, you know, what happens when you are, when you're attacking other candidates only strengthens the position of Donald Trump? Because, I mean, think about it. Since that October Des Moines Register poll, Nikki's been attacking DeSantis. DeSantis has been attacking Nikki. And Donald Trump's numbers went up. Nick, can we play that Nikki? This is Nikki Haley's new ad that's up in Iowa.
Whatever I want, he wants.
Make America great again.
Make America great again.
We're going to build the wall.
Build the wall.
Project again.
Judges are a priority. For,
and honestly, dump made in China and shipped Russia. Here. Businesses that have been locked down.
What a phony. Ron DeSantis. Too lame to lead, too weak to win. SFA Fund Inc. is responsible for the content of this advertisement.
So that was the super PAC.
Boy, that is not a tough ad.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's Nikki's super PAC. My point is to your point of like crabs in a barrel, that ad doesn't mention Nikki Haley, doesn't contrast Ron DeSantis with Nikki Haley. If anything, if you're like a Trump or Trump adjacent like voter, it's going to make you choose Donald Trump and not Ron DeSantis. It's not going to make you vote for Nikki Haley.
I mean, somewhat of an aside, it is so fun to be living in a state that is contested. So you can see ads just like
right.
ripping candidates up. That's got to be like I've had to live in blue states for so long where it's essentially just like the union is picking who's going to win. But like for folks in Iowa, New Hampshire, I know folks in Iowa know that they're like in a very fortunate position that every yeah. candidate, you know, when they run for president has to show up and grovel at your feet. But I mean, that is a hard hitting ad.
Yeah.
That is, you know, you don't see that kind of stuff unless you're in like an early voting state of like, because the whole, that ad is, you know, it's a shock and blast.
But it's,
at
it's
Ron
it's,
DeSantis.
It's,
but I think
right.
you make the right point
right.
of like,
it softens his support, but to who? What in that ad is going to make you pick Nikki Haley? Now, I guess maybe if you're running that exclusively on like CNN and your goal is to target moderate Republicans and try to peel them off of DeSantis into your bucket for Nikki Haley. Maybe that makes sense a little bit.
But I wonder what's the size of that universe.
Right. I mean, if you look at this poll, Donald Trump has 51%.
To me, that ad is kind of like, why get Diet Coke when you could have Coke?
Yeah.
You know, and that's clearly not the intention.
Well, it comes at a time when Nikki's numbers against Biden are like skyrocketing.
Yeah.
Now, did you guys see that Wall Street Journal poll?
Yeah.
Came out over the weekend and it shows her ahead of Biden by like 17 points.
Huge lead over Biden.
So I think everybody knows what's going on here, that Nikki in a general election matchup would just smoke the competition. And I really think that like phenomenon is something that our candidates need to explain. I want to hear them answer questions about, well, it looks like Nikki Haley will crush Joe Biden. Why is it that you wouldn't want to get in behind her? You know, isn't it the entire goal is to stop Biden, to stop the libs and to put a Republican in office?
Yeah, but
I want to hear the other candidate. Not saying that, I mean, the poll, you know, it shows that Trump can beat Biden.
Right.
It shows that DeSantis can beat Biden. It shows that people want something different. So, I mean, the answer to...
So, in the same Wall Street Journal poll that you're referencing, it has Trump with a 4-point lead over Biden, and it's got DeSantis in a tie with Biden, while at the same time it says Nikki's got a 17-point lead.
I mean
that's interesting, and I think you're right. Like, that is a good question to ask these candidates. And I think the answer you're going to get is like a boilerplate kind of like, oh, well, if I were the DeSantis people, I'd be like, well, Nikki hasn't had, you know, 50 million in negative ads dumped on her head.
Right. And the
when
other
it's
thing,
a general time, Republicans will coalesce.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Well, and the other thing the DeSantis people would say is like, well, it's easy to talk about theoretically winning in a poll. I won by 20 points in 2022 in the state of Florida. So I've proven I can win in a year, the 2022 election, where we were expecting a red wave and it didn't come to shore in a lot of places, but it did come to shore in Florida. So like that is a good electability argument. I think the problem for Ron DeSantis and Nikki Haley is increasingly Republican primary voters do not think that Joe Biden can beat Donald Trump. And as long as they think Donald Trump can beat Joe Biden, they're going to stick with Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think that's it. I think that's the heart of it right there.
Yeah, I mean, back to that Des Moines Register poll, it's 73% of likely caucus goers think that Donald Trump can defeat Biden despite his legal challenges. So even if they were assuming the worst, that he is a convicted felon in one of these cases, the January 6th case, Mar-a-Lago Docs case, or whatever, they still think that Donald Trump can win. And so if that's what they're believing, how do you make an electability argument?
That's the thing. So me,
you can't.
Personally, I wish I could impress this upon every Republican voter in this country, is I think Biden and the Biden campaign are way more dangerous than folks believe. The amount of money they are going to unleash, the organizations that these people have spent years, these unions that they have out there that can do their work. And they have actually invested in and focused on things like voting by mail and ballot chasing. And these operations that for so long Republicans have been told, oh, well, you know, if you put your ballot in the mail, it's going to get stolen and it'll never count. Clearly, Dems ones are getting there. And, right. and Republican ones have been getting there. I mean, permanent absentee lists are a prime example of, you know, older voters tend to skew more conservative. And you better believe they make sure that their votes count. Those have been counting. Yeah. And I think it's critical that Republicans get on board with understanding the importance of these kind of things. Voting by mail is important. And you know, showing up on election day is not the only way to vote. Start putting points on the board as soon as you can.
Money is not the only thing they're unleashing. They have Hillary Clinton now inside the campaign.
I saw this.
Calling the shots, doing the interviews. She's going to be front and center.
So I got to read this from NBC News, the headline here. Hillary Clinton steps out as a key player in Biden's reelection effort. Wild. Clinton is popular with women in key parts of the Democratic base and remains a fundraising draw who can help ensure Biden has the money to get his message out. There is still a two for the price of one theme when it comes to her family. Husband Bill Clinton made a cameo at the fundraising event at their Washington home. Clinton's role is only expected to grow in the new year. But for now, she is filling a space that at a later point in the campaign season, former President Barack Obama will join.
So this guarantees that Joe Biden will take zero questions on Jeffrey Epstein.
He's not going to he's not going to have to answer any of those questions. And he's going to have tons of money. And to Smug's point, like John Fetterman became a United States Senator. Right. And you know, Biden isn't in good shape either, but he's going to have all the money in the world, in the world to get his message out and to organize.
And he's got the national media all like covering for like, do not underestimate the ability of Democrats to win these races when their candidate is far worse. And I mean, Fetterman's a prime example, incapable of executing the job in office. They specialize in still winning elections because I think, you know, the one thing we do not need in the tent this cycle is overconfidence.
It's funny because it just feels like we're living Groundhog Day from the 2022 midterms, bad economy, inflation through the roof, you know, all the voters lining up with the issues that the Republican Party supports. From that Wall Street Journal poll that you cited earlier, Ashbrook, the fave unfave of Bidenomics. The term Bidenomics. 2952. 2952.
I want to know who's in the 29 category.
These are like, you know what? Bidenomics has worked out great.
It's unbelievable. Anyway, so this just, we had to talk about this. Smug tried to, he tried to censor us, but we're going to cover it anyway.
Parents, hide your kids.
Yeah. This is from Mediaite. Headline is Hot Mike Catches Vivek Ramaswamy Using Bathroom During X Spaces Live Stream with Elon Musk and Alex Jones.
Oh my goodness.
Vivek Ramaswamy forgot to mute himself in the bathroom while on an X Spaces live stream with Elon Musk, Alex Jones, and a slew of other right-wing personalities. The presidential candidate joined the stream.
Oh my God.
Stream, they put a parenthetical, ha. featuring Musk interviewing Jones following his return to the platform. The conversation eventually divulged into other members in the call praising the billionaire while discussing depopulation and political censorship. However, as Musk and Jones were in the middle of talking, audio could be heard coming from Ramaswamy's phone with him in the bathroom, prompting Jones and others to point it
out. Alex Jones, man. You got to the bottom of it.
Quote, someone's got their thing open peeing. Someone's got their phone open in the bathroom. Unbelievable.
So this to me, this is disqualifying. Don't take your bathroom into the phone. What the hell is wrong with you people? The amount of germs that are in there, let alone record, like... What is going on? What's the thought process behind this, man?
This is...
Be like, okay, folks, I'll be right back. Yeah, put your phone down. You go to the bathroom. You wash your hands. You come back. Just, this is normal human. Like, this is basics 101 that you teach a toddler.
Yeah.
You know, like, here's how you use the potty. You use it. You wash your hands. Then you go do what you got to do. Like, who's in there? Like, oh, you know what? I'm going to continue this interview and go to the bathroom. That's not multitasking, that's disgusting.
Okay, fine. I take the opposite point of view. This is
you support disgusting.
This is a new spin on the 3 a.m. call question. Vivek Ramaswamy will work, will talk, will do anything at any moment, even if he's going to be embarrassed. Lyndon Baines Johnson, one of the most famous things he used to do was hold staff meetings while he was going to the bathroom. And that's exactly what Vivek Ramaswamy is doing today. So maybe he could usher in the great conservative society.
I love that because it's like Vivek's running as a millennial presidential candidate, but he displays great boomer behavior. You're like, he's just like LBJ famously did, LBJ. Peeing in front of people. Forgetting to mute his mic. Unbelievable. It reminds me of sort of those early days in the pandemic, you know, when people were trying to do like Zoom conference calls and nobody would remember to mute their mics or remember that the video was on and you had Jeffrey Toobin, you know, with his crank out. Oh, great times. What a time to be alive. Oh, man. What are we covering here next?
I really can't believe that actually happened. Like, how are you not mortified?
I know.
I can believe it happened because these guys are always on. They're always doing stuff, and they just miss something. I totally can believe it happened. I mean,
so do you guys? Do you remember that great hearing that was on Capitol Hill last week? Elise Stefanik was grilling
all these presidents of these
Ivy League Iconic. Schools. Well, there's been a lot of fallout from that, deservedly so. Is from the New York Times. UPenn's leadership resigns amid controversies over anti-Semitism. The president of the University of Pennsylvania, Elizabeth McGill, resigned on Saturday, 4 days after she appeared before Congress and appeared to evade the question of whether students who called for the genocide of Jews should be punished. Support for Ms. McGill, already shaken in recent months over her approach to the Palestinian Literary Conference and the university's initial response to the Hamas attack on Israel on October 7th, unraveled after her testimony. Influential graduates questioned her leadership, wealthy contributors moved to withdraw donations, and public officials besieged the university to oust its president. Thoughts?
Yeah, so I think this is, I mean, it's obviously a really terrific thing to happen. I believe it's something Shapiro, the Attorney General of Pennsylvania, a Democrat,
yeah,
was like, she's got to go ahead of her resigning. So I think everyone realized how incredibly like stupid and out of touch this university president was. But I think the story here is not that the presidents are out of touch. Mm-hmm. It's that they have presided over this kind of moral rot at these institutions where for so long, like Ben Shapiro will show up on a campus and you'll have kids shouting him down, being like, people are going to die. Don't you realize words are violence? Like, you're going to kill people by having Ben Shapiro here.
But intifada is not violence.
Exactly. And then when like people are shouting for genocide, like, you know, words aren't violence.
It's
in
a
this
gray
situation.
Area. It's, you know, it depends on who you are trying to intifada.
So like for the past decade now at this point, we have seen universities become de facto left-wing training camps, right? It's activist training camps. They are no longer places of higher learning because, I mean, look at what they've done. So they get rid of standardized tests, essentially. Now all of their admissions practices are essentially based on who's the most woke person that we can let in here,
yeah,
right? We want to build the most left-wing possible core of students. And all of our professors, A through Z, I think it's like in Harvard, they had a faculty, what are these called? Survey that mm-hmm. they filled out. And it was something like 97% of the instructors at that campus identified as liberal or very liberal.
Yeah, they're to the left of the Bernie Sanders campaign.
But the Harvard president is also facing pressure to step down, again from the New York Times. The president of Harvard University, Claudine Gay, faced escalating pressure on Sunday to resign as prominent alumni, donors, and politicians called for her ouster. But a group of faculty members rallied to support her, arguing that she was being railroaded for a moment of poorly worded remarks about anti-Semitism.
I wonder if they would give that kind of grace. There's never that level of grace.
You know,
this is poorly worded.
Who was the investor, Ackman?
Yeah, Bill Ackman.
Bill Ackman, who's been like on a tear covering a lot of this news, I think summarized it at one point to say, like, you know, he's had a lot of experience in corporate boardrooms. And the last thing that happens before somebody resigns is the letter of support for people saying they're being railroaded.
And I think, and he brought up a great point. He's like, if this was any private company in this country, any company that had their CEO say this kind of stuff, they'd be gone instantly, instantaneously. And the fact that not only is it like, oh, yes, you know, Harvard is supposed to be a respectful institution, but that like, these are kids on a campus, and they're being shown that, oh, if this is acceptable, then I guess that's just acceptable behaviors is calling for genocide.
It's I hope we're at this tipping point where we start to pull back from this DEI culture in this country. Obviously, it's run amok in academia and also corporate boardrooms. But something really interesting I saw in the Washington Examiner from the editorial board. The title is, "Until DEI offices are closed, don't expect better college presidents." This is a great opener here. "The moral degeneracy of the presidents of three prestigious universities who recently refused to condemn calls for genocide clearly is symptomatic of a larger problem. The long-term solution must be to eliminate diversity, equity, and inclusion bureaucracies and policies, root and branch from higher education."
100% right.
I mean, it's
getting out of control.
It's out of control.
It's getting out of control. It's getting to the point where every single group of people, let me just read you a headline from the Daily Mail. "How fat pride became the new battleground in America's culture wars. 1 in 6 U.S. deaths linked to obesity, but liberal states are banning fat phobia with discrimination laws."
Yeah.
So now DEI extends to fat people. You can eat as much McDonald's as you want. You can have your internal organs covered with as much dangerous, life-threatening fat as you want, and you are a protected class.
You know, so this takes me back to something that Vivek said in the previous debate that I think is just a really great point. And we touched on it when he brought up the instance of his wife is a surgeon.
Yeah.
And she gives him, you know, firsthand accounts of what, you know, the medical field looks like today in this country. When he said that, you know, we don't have healthcare, we have sick care.
Yeah.
Our country is not focused on any programs of healthy lifestyle, right? Where, you know, it's almost like something happened, especially in the media over the past 10 years, where being like, you know what, you know, eating healthy and having a balanced diet is a good, like, you'd be attacked. You'd be like, all this is doing is this is enabling eating disorders. Like, they always go to an absolute extreme of like, you don't think it might be better to tell folks just have more vegetables?
Not meat. Not just
fish attacked, and chicken and vegetables.
Not folks. Just attacked, but sued. In this article that I've mentioned, an employer who fails to give an oversized employee a sufficiently big desk, or a restaurant that makes the mistake of seating a calorie-challenged diner at a cozy booth table could find themselves being sued.
But they're not. They're definitely
calorie-challenged.
They're not challenged. In fact, they have too many calories.
as many as they want.
And that's the other thing is, like, you know, the science of that we've known for a very long time, simply like explaining to the public how calories work. Should, like, you don't see the USDA do any of this. You don't see them like, okay, like Sunny Delight for if you're on government assistance, that counts as like a fruit juice when it's 99% sugar, because
sugar water.
Companies that own it know how to lobby to make sure that their foods are included on that so that the government ends up paying for it. But this mindset, and you look at the cover of like Self magazine and Women's Health magazine, and it'll be an obese, out of shape person who's clearly, you know, got a bunch of comorbidities that's life threatening. But this is what's being like, you're not going to see Mr. Olympia or like Arnold Schwarzenegger on the cover of these magazines anymore. It's all about like thinking,
living your truth,
except living your truth.
It's living that's your truth. Thing. And that's the inclusion part of DEI.
Have you guys, so there's a cartoon that I've watched with my kids. You guys are maybe familiar with it, called WALL-E. Have you ever seen this? I think it's like a Disney movie,
the movie?
Or Pixar or something that.
The robot one, right?
Yeah, there was a robot in the beginning, but the second half of the movie is about how people have gone into space because Earth is no good anymore. But the people in space are all laying on these floating beds, eating themselves into like fat oblivion.
Yeah.
Their and all their brains turned off.
And their bones are softening because of the low gravity. And so like their feet get fatter and their like tarsals get smaller in their feet. So they basically have like nubbins for feet and they never get off these like recumbent positions where they stare at screens all day. It's almost like a commentary on our society writ large.
It really is.
Sad.
And like, especially during COVID. I mean, you heard all these stories of how, I mean, when folks essentially were on lockdown, they're not allowed out. You saw a number beyond just the mental health issues, but like, you know, a number of health issues when people stop leaving the house. They're not mobile, right? A lot of folks just sitting at home having junk food, because what else is there to do to kill the time when you're essentially in prison? And a lot of those habits have just continued afterwards, you know?
Yeah. People in society don't have shame today, unfortunately. And that brings us to our next article.
Oh God, it is this one.
I wish we didn't have to cover this, folks.
Yep. Again, and, parents, hide your kids.
I'm sad that Holmes has to miss this, but we are going to talk about the Susanna Gibson Politico article. I don't know. Did you guys see this over the weekend?
I saw it over the weekend, but who is Susanna Gibson? This is the person who was running for like a state.
Yeah, she was running House. For state senate in Virginia, which is, you know, hotly contested legislative elections here last November. And so the race, like, it was a pretty big deal, could decide, you know, the fate of the chamber and all of that sort of thing. I'll just get into the article here. The title: her online sex life was exposed. She lost her election. Now she's speaking out. Now, if you didn't know anything about this person, you didn't follow this at all, you know, maybe you're not on Twitter, you would think that this person had some sort of like revenge porn put out by an ex-boyfriend, that her privacy was violated. And you read this article, you would also think that. There's a Q&A component here, and I'm just going to start right here. This is from Susanna Gibson. My entire life was rocked on September 11th. Aside, she was not talking about 2001.
Yeah.
Oh.
She's not talking about, you know, the terrorist attack on 9/11. Huh. She's talking about September 11th, 2023.
Okay.
When the article ran. It ran implying that I performed sex acts online with my husband for money.
Wait, implying? Isn't that what she did?
She's saying it's implying. Like, this is just, she's flabbergasted that this came out. It was really written based on this Dropbox file that self-described Republican operatives shopped around. They had found these videos on the dark web and shopped them around to various news outlets. I didn't have any idea that there were ever videos of me that had been made and uploaded to multiple sites. Now,
the amount of inconsistencies and lies in those two sentences, and that the reporter did not stop for a second and say, wait, none of this makes sense whatsoever, but continue.
So, just a level set with the audience, Susanna Gibson, I think she was on Chatterbait or one of these live streaming websites, and she was soliciting money from viewers to perform sex acts on her husband, live streaming it, video on the internet. She makes it sound here like some hacker, maybe the hacker that did all that stuff on Joy Reid's blog all those years ago, broke into her hard drive and uploaded stuff to the quote unquote dark web.
Yeah, when she makes the statement that I didn't have any idea that there were ever videos of me, I mean, maybe the number one sign that there would be video is when you put the camera right in front of you.
Yeah.
When you were doing this and live streaming it for money.
Well, let's just read from the transcript. I'm not going to play the video here for our viewers. Also, I understand she's probably pretty litigious at this point. But let's just go ahead and read part of the transcript from her live stream where she's performing sex acts on her husband and claiming that she had no idea that these videos might get out. Here's the transcript. Yeah, you can watch me pee.
Oh, God.
Let me block a few people, and then you can watch me. If you tip me in some tokens again, these are tokens that are cash, I'm raising money for a good cause. I'm not going to read more of this. So I'm allowed to get blanked in the blank, but I'm not allowed to pee. So what? You're telling me. Ridiculous. She's having a conversation with all these people in the chat as they're trying to pay her money to do stuff.
Yeah, it's like she's like, how could I have known that there would be video that people could see of this? When she's discussing during a live stream that she is herself filming that, oh, you know, if you give me money, I'll do so-and-so. But to me, a very critical point of this, again, so this video was apparently recorded after she had filed to run.
Hmm.
So when she's telling folks, give this money for a good cause, is that that's a solicitation for a campaign donation. Now, Virginia requires their candidates to report all campaign donations, same as FEC does.
Yeah, she reporting the tokens?
Did she report those tokens, right? Because she's saying this is for a good cause. So one of these people in here could make the argument that I was being told, you know, I solicited money for a good cause. I saw that she had already filed to run, and I figured I'd give money for this. So, like, she herself is open to so many legal issues that.
Here's my problem with the article. That aside, Smug, although I think it's a great point. My problem with this article is that it's complete revisionist history.
Absolutely.
And Politico is trying to run cover for this woman who did all these sex acts on the internet, acting like she's some sort of innocent victim. Right. Here.
And that's not what they do for Republicans. And I'm glad you touched on this because it's the thing about the article that gets me the most is the divergent treatment of Republicans and Democrats. Let me just read a few headlines. Let's repeat the headline that Politico gave this situation for a Democrat. Her online sex life was exposed. She lost her election. Now she's speaking out. She's a victim, but she's not taking it lying down, folks. She is going to be the hero at the end of the day. Let's read the headline on a Republican in an embarrassing situation. Politico, Bobert.
Yeah.
Caught on video, apologizes for inappropriate behavior at Beetlejuice show.
Right.
No, there's no like she's the victim and now she's ready to speak out and stand up for women.
Yeah, it's not like she consented to being videotaped in that theater, right? Was her privacy violated?
Right.
Those questions are never asked.
Here's another headline. Republican reveals his own daughter's OnlyFans account. That's what the Republican did. Nancy Mace upsets conservatives with sex talk at a prayer breakfast. There's no Nancy Mace is a victim, and here she's trying to like help people out. And I will read you a headline about something we discussed today. Vivek Ramaswamy caught peeing on hot mic.
Yeah.
You know, there was...
it's like when it's a Democrat, they're just, you know, they're a free spirit and they're a libertine. But when it's a Republican, suddenly all these journalists become puritanical about it.
But also the way that they present the whole story and argument of being like, oh, this is all about consent, because I think there's a line essentially which says if any video you don't intend for the vast public to see, it should not be allowed to be shown. That's the argument that she makes at one point, right? And the reporter just like nods along like, very good, very good. What about the whole Access Hollywood grab by the pussy? Was there ever any argument made that, listen, this was a time that was not recorded not for public consumption.
Right.
Why is this being allowed to be put out there without Donald Trump's consent? Like, the insanity of the hypocrisy that the press gives Democrats of being like, okay, here's why this person who is completely responsible for their own decisions is actually the victim.
Yeah, it's a rehabilitation for her, Susanna Gibson. And what upsets me most about this article is like there is a larger and broader point in this, which I think is actually interesting and should be explored. And it's touched on very late in the article, which is like, what is the future of political campaigning once, you know, these millennials and Zoomers are all running for political office, right? When they've probably filmed 80% of their lives, you know? I mean, what are we going to do in all those situations? But like, that's not what the article does.
Right.
For 90% of it, it's cleanup for this woman yep. who was exactly. soliciting money on the internet.
Exactly. And to your point about the Access Hollywood tape, here's CNN's headline, how the shocking hot mic tape of Donald Trump was exposed. They're the heroes. They're exposing something everybody needs to see. Democrats, when Democrats are caught in an embarrassing situation, it is call out the full janitor crew, the entire media, let's lock arms and protect this person.
Oh. And even like the wording again, I got to go back when she says, it was really written based on this Dropbox file that self-described Republican operatives shopped around. They'd found these videos on the dark web, shopped them. Like, no, they didn't. That's not how any of this shit works. That's not the dark, like throwing in these terms because right. they know like boomers hear this in commercials that talk about like, oh, someone's going to steal your like house title
right.
on the dark web.
Or yeah. Do you need title lock?
Yeah. They're going to get your credit card numbers on the dark web. Yeah. You know, like this has no hacker dark web shit going on.
You
this
live streamed
is, you put this out for the public to make money.
Yeah.
This was, you released this video yourself and are looking into the camera saying, give me money. For sex acts. That's, you said it right. yourself. Like, right. this is not like some, you know, paleontologist had to dig through bones in Utah to find this. Yeah.
Oh, great stuff. All right. Well, I think we should probably get to our interview. Kellyanne Conway.
We're very, very lucky today to have one of the most sought after pollsters in the country and one of the top strategic thinkers on the Republican side, Kellyanne Conway.
Hey, it's great to be with you. Thanks for having me back on Ruthless.
Yeah, well, we are so thrilled that you could be with us today because, you know, everybody is talking about the latest polls and we're hoping that you can decipher them for us, particularly this new Des Moines Register poll in Iowa. Obviously, we're 1 month out from the caucuses. President Trump has a commanding lead over the field in that state. And so one of the things I was wondering is, do you see any path at all for Ron DeSantis or Nikki Haley to shock the world and upset the president next month?
Well, John, the latest poll really reinforces what's been going on practically for the last year or so. And really since President Trump went and visited East Palestine, Ohio, which I think was a big inflection point in this election season. And that said, he has a commanding lead in the Republican primary, and President Trump is growing his lead in the general election rematch, cage match rematch over Joe Biden. I thought stunningly, the New York Times poll from November showing Trump leading Biden in 5 of the 6 swing states was pretty remarkable to see. I don't know why these media outlets who don't like Trump and want Biden or another Democrat to be the president beginning in 2025 keep polling at all, because their polls are particularly bad for Biden, whether it's personal attributes, for example, cares about people like me, has a plan for the middle class, has the energy or agility, acuity to do the job and so forth, or on policy issues. Every single one of the policy issues now shows Joe Biden underwater, with more people disapproving than approving of his handling of said issue. Every diverse issue, from the Middle East to Ukraine to the border, crime, the economy and inflation, energy, you name it, and Biden's numbers are upside down. But I think the tale of Trump's dominance can be seen in a few ways, and then I'll get to your second question. It's an important one as to, can anyone catch him? It can be seen in a few ways. One is that he's the guy who had the job before. And when any of us want to hire someone to do a job, big or small in our lives, we have a bias to hire someone who's done the job before. That's why we look at resumes and references. That's why you get word of mouth from people you trust who are pleased with perhaps an employee or someone providing a service or goods. And that's the way many in America look at former President Trump. They're saying, well, if I had to just compare the job you did on the issues I care about, with everything else put aside for the moment, compared to the way Joe Biden's handled his job, it's a clear call for many Americans. Now, as for whether Nikki Haley or Ron DeSantis or another Republican can catch Trump, quote unquote, the answer is, if everything stays the same, probably not, meaning if there's not some catastrophic event that prevents former President Trump from being the nominee. Mm-hmm. They're running out of time leading up to Iowa. We're within a month of Iowa, practically. And this latest Des Moines Register poll, as you point out, that they do with NBC News and others, shows Trump with the largest lead in the history of the poll. Mm-hmm. He's at 51%. So since their last poll, Trump's gone up by 8%. DeSantis has gone up by 3%. That's after he got 2 key endorsements by sitting very popular Governor Kim Reynolds and Bob Vanderplatz, who, of course, is a very respected pro-life, pro-family leader in Iowa. And Nikki Haley's pretty much at 16%, despite all the king's horses and all the king's men and the establishment Republican Party and the donor class, you know, moving toward her and a lot of media attention that she's received after these debates. So there's that. I think the tale of 2023 really is how Trump was able to increase his lead and Ron DeSantis pretty much cratered. I'm sorry for Ron DeSantis because I think he's been a great governor of Florida. My advice from the beginning to him and to others was not to run. I think he may have hurt himself for 2028 as well. The idea that any Republican primary voter, let alone most of them, wants to talk about COVID in 2024 and Anthony Fauci just is not a read of the people. And I'm sorry that I don't think he would have fired Fauci. He can't even fire the people, you know, raking in tens of millions of dollars and embarrassing him on the daily. So I think he could be a great two-term governor of Florida, but they're all running out of time and we'll see what happens. But, you know, if Trump wins Iowa and then goes to New Hampshire, where he also has a big lead now, goes into Nikki Haley and Tim Scott, South Carolina, and wins there, got Nevada in there too in the mix. But look, this is politics. Anything can happen. I think they're all waiting for him to, God forbid, die on the golf course or be convicted somewhere in a serious way where he somehow is disabled from being the nominee. But I would say don't bank on either of those.
Well, that's I'm glad you brought that up because, you know, you also mentioned East Palestine and the president's work on that in the aftermath of that tragedy was huge. And I agree with you that was really the start of his rise back to domination of the Republican side. But also over the summer, as these indictments were coming down from the Biden Justice Department, Trump's numbers seemed to go up every single time. And I'm wondering, Kellyanne, if next year at some point in the spring, in the early summer, if those indictments start turning into convictions, does that have a material impact on either center-right voters, center-left voters who might be who were certainly in play in 2016? Is that going to have a different effect than the indictments did last summer?
Well, it could for some voters. And most of the people who talk about those indictments in a negative way are already against Trump. Mm-hmm. It also just depends on we as voters. I said this in 2016 after Access Hollywood and many days after that, but I'll say it again now. Voters tend to discuss what offends them, mm-hmm. but they vote according to what affects them. Mm-hmm. And you see in everybody's polling, including our own, John, just the number of Americans who are facing economic distress and anxiety mm-hmm. about their own financial situation, who feel that they feel pessimistic about the future. I know Jay Powell and the Fed and other inflation watchers are saying great job getting that under control. And there is an argument to be made at the macroeconomic level, but politics and voters is about microeconomics. And so many people, particularly less than a third of young people under the age of 35, feel the economy is going well. So if they can cast all that aside, then perhaps. Now, if he's convicted, then people are going to want to know what's the appeals process, can you still serve, etc. It could change some voters, but it could change some minds. But right now, I think the question is really Joe Biden. And this is why I say it. He's currently the president. And I tell Republicans routinely, I own the prize. If you're talking about the presidential election, we currently have a president and a vice president. They could get reelected, believe it or not, even given how unpopular they are, how underwater they are and their approvals on all the major issues.
Just a horrible thought.
it's a horrible thought, but it happens. And it could happen because the Democrats are just brilliant on mechanics now. They have no interest in elevating and electing quality leaders. If you don't believe me, believe them. They just elected and elevated Kamala Harris, Joe Biden, and John Fetterman, and a few other buttes the last couple of years alone. They're interested in power and keeping it. And the way they do that, John, is not in inspiring people on for whom to vote, or even why to vote philosophically or policy-wise, but they tell you how to vote, meaning through which method, and where to vote, when to vote. They're all about getting people to the polls, and they've done a masterful job of that, even in some of these special elections in 2023, and certainly a gubernatorial election in a place like Kentucky, and even in 2022. So I have my eye on the prize, and I still think Biden's erosion among big erosion among core Democratic groups that he had a scaffold together to win in 2020 in the first place are leaving him. You see all Muslims in, for example, Muslim Americans in Michigan saying, I'm going to stay home. Many Jewish voters upset with Biden and his administration over what's happening in the Middle East. Young people upset with him for any number of reasons, but particularly financial freedom. When are they going to buy their first home? When are they going to feel comfortable enough to add other people to their, quote, payroll in the household, meaning a family, a spouse, and children. So I believe that Donald Trump as the nominee would bring along not just his base. He's well past that. It's a base plus now. And the plus includes more non-college educated, non-white voters, particularly male voters. It includes more self-identified independents who favor Trump in most polls over Biden by double digits. And it includes, I think, more women, and it includes more young people. Now, the biggest wild card of all, maybe even more than the convictions on this electorate, are the third party candidacies. You know, when Ross Perot ran in 1992 as a third party candidate, he won 19% of the vote nationwide, John, but he got zero electoral votes, the same number you and I got that year. And Bill Clinton became a two-term president. He received 68.8% of the electoral votes in 1992, but he only got 45% of the popular vote. It's easy to forget that. And that could happen again because there are so many more billionaires now. I don't know them. There are about 1,100, I read, in this country. Somebody can just say, do what Michael Bloomberg did, except do it a heck of a lot better, and come in late, maybe as a third party candidate, and really shake things up. Maybe they can win a state or two. So we can actually have a president elected in 2024, just about 40% of the vote, maybe even less, depending on how many third party candidates are in there.
Which is just wild. And it's probably the only thing that keeps Biden optimistic about his chances. I mean, you mentioned how effective they are at turning out their vote. What they're not effective at is helping people with the problems that are pressing them most. I mean, they're not doing anything about the border. The economy is in bad shape. You and I have talked about how people are so concerned about housing prices and rent and utilities and everything else. Crime is on the rise and out of control. And yet you have the Biden administration focused on things like banning gas stoves, banning water heaters, ceiling fans, menthol cigarettes. So that can't be popular with people who are looking for actual help with real problems.
It's not popular. It makes people feel that government creep is real and that Uncle Sam and Big Brother are literally coming to their homes, following them around. What are you smoking? How are you cooking? How are you preparing your meals or your hair that day? And there is the Biden administration to tell you, hold on, you can't do it that way. So it makes no sense to them. It's offensive to them. It's an erosion of their freedom. But also, if you're the Biden administration, my goodness, that's number 800 on a list of top 10 in terms of your priority and how to spend your political currency. And we've done surveys nationwide and in states like Nevada and North Carolina, which are swing states, where people are saying, hey, start focusing on pressing issues and stop with this other nonsense that you just mentioned, like the menthol cigarettes, the gas stoves, et cetera. And I think more to the point here is that the Biden administration took a big hit last week. They said they were going to stop. They heard from Al Sharpton. They heard from libertarians and conservatives. And Al Sharpton warned them. For example, I can pick an issue like this every week, but this just happened last week, so we can discuss it, John. They said, oh, we're going to hit pause on our menthol cigarette ban. Well, that's after they heard from Al Sharpton and conservatives and other freedom-loving people saying you're going to create a black market. This helps the cartels. And you're going to disproportionately hurt black smokers. Who even told you that this was a good idea. So every time you look at the Biden administration, they're either yelling squirrel and going in a different direction, or they're lying. And I think they've just become and are everything they accuse our administration of being on the daily. Holman Jenkins, the Wall Street Journal, had a piece this weekend. You and I were discussing. It was called "The Never Trumpers Never Learn." And of course, they look totally ridiculous, that whole lot of nepo babies and misfits. Because they're just empowering Trump. They make him a victim. They have no idea what they're talking about politically. But he made a good point. He said in there, it began with Russia collusion. And really, since then, no lie was too big or small or would create any shame, my words. He said, because the way the Never Trumpers look at it is that Trump's so bad, we must lie about him. We must, just to sort of hold him to account. And to your point about the indictments, people just see that as, they see that as themselves. They truly do see that as themselves. And I think it has helped the president. But the other thing I've got to give him his due. He has been talking about policy. The irony is, of all these Republicans running for president, the one who some days, not all days, the one who some days is most on message is Donald Trump. Right. He actually, when he did his interview with Sean Hannity last week for an hour in Iowa, where he's now leading with 51% of the vote, according to the new poll, he was talking about the economy, energy, crime, Putin, the Middle East. It was regulation. It was policy. And when he sticks to policy prescriptions, and you can compare him versus Biden on that, aces.
I actually think that that's one of the biggest stories that hasn't been told this election cycle, is not only how President Trump is basically staying focused on his message, but also how organized his campaign is this time around.
They're doing a great job.
They have such a good team in Iowa. They've got such a good team all over the country. Everybody seems to be reporting in. You know, their press team is very aggressive. They're pushing things in a conventional way that you would expect from like the Bush Cheney 04 team. And this is Donald Trump in 2024. And, you know, as compared to where they started in 2015 with basically just like one guy from the Santorum's driver, I think it was, in Iowa. And now they've just got like a huge organization.
Yes.
And nobody's really talked about that. But that's, I think in a lot of ways, that's been the secret to their success.
You know, as his campaign manager in 2016, I will tell you, I'm a huge fan of his 2024 campaign. I think Susie Wiles is doing a fantastic job. He's got Chris LaCivita there, who didn't even meet him till last year, but Susie and Chris are at the top echelon. He's got really talented and creative people, incisive people like Stephen Chung, who I met on the 2015-2016 campaign. And I think he was super glued to his chair. You know, people like him in the war room, and it was much smaller, as you can imagine, at the Trump campaign in New York as compared to Hillary in Brooklyn. They worked round the clock. And by the time I got there, I just thought they needed someone to juice them up and get them on eight cylinders. But the talent is there and the discipline. Mm-hmm. What I like about the Trump campaign that does not get talked enough about is their focus on mechanics also. They are all about delegate acquisition. And you've got the media out there having a love affair with DeSantis for the last couple of years. The donors doing the same. Then it was Tim Scott. Now it's Nikki Haley. You've got the mainstream media and some of the donors with their love affair with Chris Christie. That's all fine. It's a free country. But they've been focused on, as some people say, pushing mud. And as a Philadelphia Eagles fan, I will tell you, they've been focused on three clouds, you know, 3 yards in dust, and a couple of Mary passes, but it's paying off. I think that they're taking the long view. So 2016 worked out for Donald Trump because it was the kind of campaign that fit an outsider. The hunger, the swagger, he was underestimated, under-resourced, understaffed, underdog. And then 2020, Brad Parscale and Jared Kushner and a lot of them, I've been highly critical of that campaign. They had $1.6 billion. I wrote about it in my book, $1.6 billion. Mm-hmm. And they couldn't beat Joe Biden, who was falling asleep in his basement. It's pretty pathetic. And I say that because I think the 2024 campaign takes the best of both worlds. They have an incumbent's record on policy and how loyal so many voters in this country are to him and want him back in office, John. Mm-hmm. And they have combined that with the same hunger, swagger, underestimated, underdog, Trump's dead on his back after the November midterms last year, blah, 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 nonsense of the punditry, which thankfully is always wrong. And they've combined the two, and they've got a really good campaign going on.
Well, with everything that's been thrown their way, it's just stunning how well they've been able to keep the main
thing. The
main thing. I mean, they really are. They're doing everything you're supposed to be doing. And that's a real contrast to Joe Biden, who is not doing anything that voters are looking for. I mean, we were talking about just a minute ago, the menthol, the gas stoves and everything else. He is just, like you say, look, squirrel, squirrel, squirrel. And none of it is actually what's interesting to voters and what voters really
want. I
mean,
look at the electric vehicles. Just to go back, since you're allowing us to talk about, you and I are both talking about East Palestine and Ohio. You know, Pete Buttigieg finally showed up there, since it was a transportation issue. Mm-hmm. He finally showed up there grudgingly, looked miserable. Biden, I don't know, either went or didn't go. But the point is, Trump went first. And then what did they do instead through the Department of Transportation, through executive orders, through Inflation Reduction Act, and all this other nonsense or stimulus packages? They've pushed this electric vehicle stuff, the $7.5 gazillion, and not a single thing has been built yet. And people see that. They're saying, well, the average cost of electric vehicle is approximates what the average household income in this country is. Their priorities are so misaligned. And look, I've been in polling for decades now. My first job in polling, $8 an hour, was 1987. I want to say something. I've never seen the polls give a more clear path as to, quote, what the people want. You've never had this many people, this many diverse people in this country of 335 million. John, tell us what's vexing and perplexing them and keeping us up at night. And for Donald Trump to have a plus 22 advantage over Biden on the economy in the New York Times poll, that means it spans every demographic group, even those who don't necessarily give him an advantage, like women. Like, I was talking to him he called me the other day, and we were talking about possible running mates and, you know, just shooting the breeze. I don't work for him. I'm just in full disclosure for your podcast. I'm a Fox News contributor, and you know, just, he was going through the list and everything, and I said, you know, Mr. President, I know people say you've got to have a woman, Joe Biden kept saying that. He sounded like a male co-ed at the end of a frat party on a Saturday night. Got to get a woman, And look what we got. Good God. So as a woman in the room, often the woman in the room, certainly in the Trump campaign and the Trump White House, I will tell you, John, you know, sure, there's lots of qualified women out there. That would be terrific. But we beat the Queen Bee herself, who was about to be the first female president of the United States of America and make history on her own, with the majority of the voters being female. 8 years before that, with an open seat presidency, David Plouffe, David Axelrod, the folks, the smart people around Barack Obama, kind of did the same thing. They knew they had to get the first Black president elected while a majority of the voters in this country were white. And so I think it's a great lesson also in not putting people in these ridiculous demographic, geographic, political boxes. This is a beautiful country filled with amazing people, and we don't fit the stereotypes that people want to slap onto our shoulders and our foreheads. And that's a great thing, because the undercover hidden Trump voter from 2016, the phrase I coined, that to international derision, and people said, oh, the hidden Trump voter will still be hidden on election day. They were real then. I think they're real now. They weren't real in 2020. When I saw people in the Trump campaign in 2020 saying, well, we have a hidden Trump vote, I'm like, no, you don't. They're out in their red MAGA hats, standing in the snow at his rallies, and they're having boat parades. But this time, I think it is people who don't look like they would be, or are voting for Donald Trump, or voting Republican at all down ballot. But we'll see. I think we need that message from the top through our nominee to actually help some of these down ballot races.
Well, Kellyanne, I'm confident you will not list the names that you discussed with President Trump for VP, but can we ask, were any of them among the challengers for the White House?
Well, they were discussed. I can't say that they're on the short list or long short list, and not because they're running. I mean, I think they failed to capture the imagination and the trust of the Republican electorate based on their candidacy so far. And that's really the thing here. If you didn't run this time, we can all still pretend, because we don't know otherwise, that the Republican electorate likes you or would fancy you. Look, that does happen. Mike Pence did not run in 2016. He was chosen for different reasons. I was intimately involved in that. He was chosen for other reasons. But he certainly was the president. Mr. Trump was certainly considering other folks like Scott Walker, or people wanted him to consider John Kasich. I don't think that was that real, but there were other people on the list then. So it's not a deal breaker, but I think we've got to ask why those candidates, given all the opportunity they've had now, mm-hmm. to with these big endorsements in a place like Iowa, a debate stage times four, 90 minutes times four, national platforms to show the Republican primary electorate why, and the independent electorate, why they're a great alternative to President Trump. And they failed to do that. Why do I think they failed? Because, and I know them all, I'm friendly with all of them. One of them is a very close friend of mine, in fact. But the fact is that they failed because Donald Trump's at 51% in Iowa and wasn't even on the debate stage.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think that President Trump, I'm not a big fan of identity politics to begin with, but I think President Trump should think about his selection, if he is the nominee, should think about the selection the way he did in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
2016, I was very cold and calculating about it because I didn't understand why some of our Republican nominees were choosing as they had in more recent elections. But I think he should also, I know he'll be considering some women, there's no doubt, but he should also consider a candidate of color because the realignment, particularly of Hispanic Americans, away from the Democratic Party, John, and migrating toward the Republican Party is stunning. It's stunning and is on the march. And why is that? Well, of course, it's got to do with economic upward mobility, but it also has to do with the outward hostility that so many Democrats now have toward religion, have toward school choice and charter schools. Mm-hmm. They misread Hispanic Americans' views on immigration and the border.
Yeah, that's loud and clear.
They stereotype them. And Republicans are smartening up on that. And it's that, it's the education, it's certainly crime and public safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that you see that, and you see some of these polls, again, by the mainstream media showing that President Trump doing better among African Americans, Asian Americans, and Hispanic Americans than he has in his previous two elections. That's a big wake-up call, I think, for Biden and the Democrats. And look, he needs to pick somebody who can debate Kamala Harris.
Mm-hmm.
And that's most people.
That's not the most difficult
job. Well, that's
job
the teleprompter.
Yeah.
I mean, she debates a teleprompter every day, and that teleprompter wins each and every time.
Kellyanne, you've been very generous with your time here, but before we let you go, I just have to ask you one more question. You're obviously still talking to the president a lot. What are the odds that we see a return of Kellyanne Conway to the White House should he win another term?
Oh, that's a great question. Well, that is up to the new President Trump.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you, I love my job because this is a beautiful country filled with amazing people. And I work with folks who got fired after 6 months, who said, I'm just going to stay a year and move on. I think that people should be in those jobs who want to do those jobs, who understand the personal and financial, and I think in some of our cases, public safety, privacy sacrifices you make. There's so much need in this country and growing by the day that if you are sufficiently doe-eyed about that and you actually want to serve for the right reasons, and I have that heart and my age and stage in my life, I would love to go back into an administration in a meaningful way that I thought could actually serve people.
Hmm.
So it is definitely something. But, you know, originally when I went in 2016, I was one of the last people who said yes, because I wanted to stay on the outside and create what we never got and what we'll need again, which is we would need, I would say, and get this time, which is what I call the surround sound. You need a big operation
right.
On the outside. Ooh. That can help you pass this legislation, get those judicial nominees confirmed faster, get the grassroots all in order. And that takes money, that takes time, talent, and treasure.
Mm-hmm.
So when Obama was elected, Axelrod went into the White House, Plouffe stayed out, and did that, built that surround sound. President George W. Bush had one. And I believe that President Trump's going to need that in a major way. That may be a good role because I have good credit with the grassroots, but also the donor community. I think the conservative media and a lot of folks even now who aren't supporting President Trump, who will be the first ones in line at his inauguration and in his new White House to try to help with policy. And I take all comers. I always say yes. So we shall see.
Yeah, well, listen, we can't thank you enough for spending some time with us today. If people want to follow along with your activity, what's the best place for them to go?
Probably my website, KellyanneConway.com. I'm probably the most private public person you'll ever meet. I don't have Instagram or Facebook. I think I checked Twitter a few weeks ago. Uh-huh. But the website's a good way. I'm on Fox News all the time. And Ruthless, occasionally. I wanted to thank you for having me back. And I wanted to congratulate you and your colleagues at Ruthless, because I know that you started during COVID. And the one of the only things that any of us want to still exist from COVID is Ruthless.
Well, thank you very much for saying that. And thank you for coming on the show today, Kellyanne Conway.
Anytime. Take care.
I mean, it was a real treat to have her on the show.
Yeah.
She's very smart, dialed in. She's got polls going in every single state at every single time. And she is like somebody who you definitely should follow. You definitely should listen to, because she has all the most up-to-date information about what people are thinking.
And sure, I mean, like you said, she's been known for a while as being a polling expert and absolutely knows what she's talking about in that arena.
Yeah, and the first, you know, successful female campaign manager for president of the United States, people forget that, mm-hmm. you know, because it's Donald Trump, so it doesn't count, right? You know, the liberal media doesn't talk about how great Kellyanne Conway did mm-hmm. in that campaign. Of course,
never would.
Never would. But she's got obviously tons of experience. I'm glad we were able to have her on. Fellas, I think we did it.
I think so. Absolute banger of an episode. Gentlemen, thanks again, Kellyanne Conway, for visiting our show. And thank you so much, dear listeners. Remember, check out that Christmas sale we have going on in the store. So until next time, minions, keep the faith, hold the line, and own the libs. We'll see you on Thursday. Stay ruthless.